From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this is the sound of incendiary munitions in the area of East Ghouta in Syria on March 7th. Syrian government forces have been laying siege to the Damascus suburb for months. The result has been endless anguish and misery. Doctors Without Borders has said that in the 2 weeks between February 18th and March 3rd, over 1,000 people were killed. More are reported every day. But not reported enough, says one reporter. Not nearly enough.
Thalia Beatty is a journalist with Storyful, a news outlet that monitors and fact-checks social media for news outlets to use. She got in touch with us, writing, quote, "The silence around this brutal stage in the Syrian war is difficult to reconcile with what I'm seeing." She's been watching the stream of horrific videos and posts from East Ghouta, all featuring civilians caught in the crossfire or just plain targeted in a bloody civil war, victims of a scorched earth campaign by the Assad regime trying to rout opposition fighters, just as in Aleppo in late 2016.
Some heartbreaking video from Aleppo today, children begging for food, their desperate attempt at evacuation uncertain. We have the very latest. That's next.
That brutal siege, unlike the current atrocities, became big news here, at least in part because the U.S. government was agonizing over its responsibilities.
It has been one of the hardest issues that I've faced as president. The world, as we speak, is united in horror at the savage assault by the Syrian regime and its Russian and Iranian allies on the city of Aleppo.
And just last year, more headlines were generated by the bombing of Raqqa by a U.S.-led coalition.
The battle to dislodge ISIS from its makeshift capital, Raqqa, in Syria, is intensifying as U.S.-backed militia press the offensive.
And then those headlines ceased, with our goal apparently achieved, the displacement of ISIS from the heart of its so-called Islamic State. But Storyful's Thalia Beatty says it's been far more difficult to focus the world's attention on the horrors in East Ghouta, despite the carnage wrought by airstrikes that haven't ceased for weeks.
We saw that begin to intensify in January and then very much intensify in February, with hundreds of people being killed a day.
How are you able to piece together and to meter the intensity of these attacks and the death toll from where you are?
Well, it's fascinating because the media environment is actually very rich there. There are people we consider media activists, and there are people who we consider news outlets. And they release videos to YouTube and Facebook. We can communicate with the people who do this, and because of satellite imagery, we're able to verify not every single piece of footage, but many. Then there are other corroborating reports from these same news outlets or from outlets based in Damascus, where the Syrian government is. So there are sources to be had. There's actually an incredible effort by people who are living there to bring attention to this conflict.
You have been corresponding with two little girls in Ghouta, Noor, who is 10, and Ala, who is 8, and they speak English, and they are under siege. Tell me who they are.
Their mother is an English teacher, and they take videos of themselves.
We are Noor and Ala from East Ghouta. Today was very difficult day here in East Ghouta. More than 200 attacks here in Ghouta.
At first it was in their classroom, and then it was in their home. Sometimes it was doing homework at night. You can hear at times warplanes overhead. And then it just gets increasingly more desperate. There's a video of dust and screaming, and we are fairly confident that we can, you know, match that video to footage that they've taken previously. It seems like the place where they live.
To everyone who can hear me, how many victims do you want to see before stopping the bombing? Hundreds of children and civilians killed and injured. You are just watching. What is happening here?
This is what I mean when I say that while it's not possible to be there in person, it is very possible to reach these people. Their mother wrote me, like, very forcefully in November, repeatedly trying to get me to bring attention to this conflict. And it really wasn't until 2 or 3 weeks ago that their videos were recognized by news outlets. A young girl ran a Twitter account from East Aleppo that garnered a great deal of attention.
Thousands of people around the world have been following the Twitter account of a 7-year-old girl. I don't know if we can take the picture of 7-year-old Bana full screen just to show.
My name is Bana. I'm 7 years old. I am talking to the world now live from East Aleppo. This is my last moment to either live or die.
There are remarkable parallels. The fact that these people are being killed is not news enough. It really is quite remarkable, and it makes me feel quite crazy.
If we were to judge only by mainstream Western media, East Ghouta is hardly going on at all. This, compared to the sieges of Aleppo and of Raqqa, which did get quite a bit of Western coverage. What's the difference?
In my mind, it's a political difference. In Aleppo, if East Aleppo fell, that would be the end of a political future in Syria for the opposition. And it did fall.
Events have moved in his favor. His army has dealt the rebels a major defeat in Aleppo. Mr. Assad is stronger now than ever. And his great ally, Russia, is the major force behind the truce agreement.
And the story in Raqqa, you know, also has a global significance. It was a U.S.-backed fight against ISIS, which was holding the city.
As ISIS loses its grip on its self-proclaimed capital of Raqqa, CNN has the first journalists actually inside the old city. Stay with us.
It was also a siege of a civilian population and very deadly. And then when you look at East Ghouta, you have the Syrian government fighting opposition groups that have been under siege for years. And there's not an active U.S. presence there. It just doesn't seem that media outlets know how to tell this story of human suffering without a geopolitical angle.
There's a number of other factors that could be at play. You know, one of them is just the sheer Trumpization of the U.S. news feed. He sucks sort of all of the journalistic oxygen out of the air. The other is the impossible situation on the ground for Western journalists in Syria. And then, of course, there's other global distractions, such as North Korea. How much do those factors play into our seeming to have turned, you know, a blind eye towards humanitarian crisis in Eastern Ghouta?
A great deal. But I also think that there are things happening that are of global interest. The UN Security Council approved a ceasefire in East Ghouta that was essentially ignored starting the next day. I don't know of the last time that has happened. It is, I think, newsworthy. It's something to talk about. We live in an era of different norms. And Trump's presidency, I think, is part of that. I think there's a whole series of perspectives on why the response now, when 1,000 people are killed in 2 weeks, is different from the response when a sarin gas attack killed 1,400 people in East Ghouta.
The conflict took an even uglier turn in 2013 when the government used sarin gas against the people in the Damascus suburb of Ghouta. I don't think anyone can forget seeing the images of the children's bodies wrapped in these white shrouds.
You know, that captured the eyes of the world. It is a different moment.
That is a bit peculiar when a regime kills its own citizens with outlawed chemical weapons, the outrage ticks up worldwide. When they use ordinary munitions, killing exactly the same number of people or more, the world seems less put out.
It is remarkable from my perspective. The reason why chemical weapons are a news hook is because they were a red line for President Obama, which he let slide, and Trump has talked about that he would take a stronger stand on. This week, Nikki Haley, the ambassador to the UN, said that the U.S. would do something. There's something to talk about with the chemical weapons.
There's one other factor that may be at play here. The struggle seems to be lost for the Assad opposition. It seems to be just a matter of time before he finally prevails. Is it that the world's just given up?
Well, this is a very important moment because if the world has given up, we will watch the same thing happen in Idlib and Hama, where the opposition also holds territory. They're different groups, but if it's okay to enact a scorched earth campaign against the opposition, against the civilians that live there, if it's okay in East Ghouta, then my anticipation is that we will see that happen again. So I think this is a newsworthy moment, an important point in how this war ends, if it does.
On the subject of stories that people are trying to tell, please tell me about Ahmad Hamdan.
So Ahmad Hamdan and Amr al-Mohbani, I consider them media activists. They take videos and photos. One of them, Hamdan, for a local media activist site. And the other, Amr's photos, are frequently published by AFP, Agence France-Presse. But they also had this comedy sketch that they would do about life under siege. They've started several campaigns where they've tried to draw attention to the airstrikes on East Ghouta, one of which was hashtag, I am still alive. And of course, that's very sad because Ahmad Hamdan was killed this week in the bombing.
We actually have the tape of one of their videos. These two guys are sitting playing checkers, only with cookies. And, you know, it's very dark sort of comedy. And they're having a chit-chat about the political situation.
Okay, so what? Just to run it through, he says, is there something new? And then Hamdan says, well, do you think the ninth round of Geneva talks will solve things? And Amr says, why is there a ninth round? And Ahmad Hamdan says, I don't know, I stopped following after the fourth. Like, I didn't know Ahmad Hamdan. I corresponded mostly with his friend Amr. But you can see in these videos and in the posts he has on Facebook that he's a person with really a sense of humor. In Arabic, you say, damu khafif, his blood is light. And it's really amazing to watch people make the best of their lives, to just live their lives in whatever situations they find themselves. I want to encourage people to tear their gaze away from like the magnetic force of the White House and to look in the other places in the world. There are many things happening, and there are many ways to tell these stories that are compelling, even though they obviously include really terrible elements.
Thalia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thalia Beatty is a journalist with Storyful, a news agency that monitors and fact-checks social media for other news outlets.
Coming up, once maps, like history, were drawn by the victors, not so much anymore.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Syrian journalist Zeyna Erhem told the AP this week that while Syria is still called Syria on the map, she could no longer recognize it because, she said, if you can think about an ordinary Syrian who wants to go from Dara to Idlib, can you think about how many countries or nationalities he's going to be passing to reach there? AP noted that a short list would include Lebanon's Hezbollah, Syrian troops, Russian pilots, Al-Qaeda-linked jihadis, U.S.-allied Kurdish forces, and Turkish tank crews. It's a grim illustration of a universal truth, that national names and borders have always been real and imaginary at the same time. In fact, the world map that we're so used to seeing, known as the Mercator projection, is riddled with topographical and political distortion. Its flaws were famously unpacked on the TV show The West Wing.
Look at Greenland, and now look at Africa.
Okay.
The two land masses appear to be roughly the same size.
Yes.
Would it blow your mind if I told you that Africa is in reality 14 times larger?
Yes.
Here we have Europe drawn considerably larger than South America. When it's 6.9 million square miles, South America is almost double the size of Europe's 3.8 million. Germany appears in the middle of the map when it's in the northernmost quarter of the Earth.
Wait, you're telling me that Germany isn't where we think it is?
Nothing's where you think it is. When third world countries are misrepresented, they're likely to be valued less. When Mercator maps exaggerate the importance of Western civilization, when the top of the map is given to the northern hemisphere and the bottom is given to the southern, then people will tend to adopt top and bottom attitudes.
Where else could you put the northern hemisphere but on the top?
On the bottom.
Yeah, but you can't do that.
Why not?
Because it's freaking me out.
The Mercator projection remains the template for Google Maps, the world's preferred mapping service. But Google sometimes compounds these age-old distortions because of its eagerness to please. Because maps are essentially political, and Google is virtually omnipotent. Miranda Bogan, a political analyst at a nonprofit called Upturn, has been tracking Google Maps' thorny foray into politics. Miranda, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Google would have us believe that it's a completely neutral geopolitical actor, and yet, not so much. I mean, for instance, both Palestine and Israel claim Jerusalem as its capital, and yet, if you search capital of Israel in Google Maps, it'll take you to Jerusalem, and if you search capital of Palestine, it'll also take you to Jerusalem. Why these multiple versions of the map?
Google wants to organize all of the information without taking a position. Maps, they're so tied to identity that it would not be in Google's interest to show users in one country a map that made a claim about their particular borders if that was offensive to those users. Those users would turn to Google's competitors, Microsoft, Bing, or Apple Maps.
Sure they would.
That's the theory anyway. And users have threatened to leave Google Maps when they've seen maps that offend them.
So the borders of Arunachal Pradesh, a region administered by India but claimed as a section of Tibet by China, which also claims Tibet, it's one of several contested areas along the border. How did they deal with that one?
So in 2007, it had looked like Google changed the color of a border in its Google Earth product in a way that implied the territory was administered by China but claimed by India, when in fact it was the reverse. When an Indian publication pointed this out, Google said that it marks its border according to international standards, but the next week the map went back to its original labels.
But then in 2009, there was a bug in Google's software update. It showed Indian users the name of the region in Chinese characters, and this was going on as the two countries were preparing for a meeting to discuss border issues.
Exactly. This was also a problem because there are these local laws that require maps to show whatever the government of that country authoritatively says is true.
And so now there are three maps, right? Basically, there's the one that the Chinese users see, the one that the Indian users see, and the map that the rest of the world sees.
Google realized it was able to show local versions of maps that comply with local laws and local expectations, but also that it could show a different map to the rest of the world, conveying that this was a contested area.
But they don't want to show that to the very people who couldn't be more aware that they're contested.
These companies are constrained by the markets that they operate in, so they might not be able to.
This mess happened in 2009. We come to 2010. A Nicaraguan military commander named Aiden Pastora led an invasion across its southern border into Costa Rica. Pastora told the press that he was in the right, according to Google Maps.
And there were headlines covering that incident, calling it the first Google Maps war, which is astounding.
We know Google is powerful, but strong enough to start a war? Almost.
Nicaragua accidentally invaded Costa Rica because of a Google Maps mistake.
Nicaraguan troop commander entered an area near the San Juan River and took down Costa Rica's flag and raised its own Nicaraguan flag. Nicaragua blamed bad border markings on Google Maps.
When you really looked closely, it became apparent that the Nicaraguan troops actually went into the area before consulting Google Maps. But Google Maps was a convenient foil.
Because it had incorrectly marked the border.
Exactly. And the Costa Rican government reached out to Google, which then conferred with the U.S. State Department, which provided some of the data about that border. And they eventually fixed the error, even though the Nicaraguan government asked them to keep it as it was.
And it was significant that while the United Nations is technically the world's cartographic authority, Costa Rica first turned to Google to remedy the situation. And while Google is informed by the UN's decisions, it doesn't have to comply with them. When Russia annexed Crimea in 2014, what did the UN say and what did Google do?
The UN initially condemned the move. The international community didn't want to condone Russian action. What Google did was it created a version of its maps to portray the annexation to the Russian users. But for the Ukrainian browsers, it didn't show any difference in the conclusive border.
I can't imagine a more palpable example of how the digital world can lock us so tightly into our echo chambers that we never have to recognize a universal truth.
That's exactly right. As companies show users what they want to see, what they expect to see, they become accustomed to seeing more of that. And then when they're confronted with a different opinion, they're all the more ready to argue over that because they're sure that their version of reality is the one that the entire world ought to believe. 2 years after Russia's initial invasion, Google actually changed the labels of certain places on the Crimean Peninsula. And Russia actually accused Google's move of topographical cretinism. And Russia actually then threatened Google's ability to do business within Russia if it didn't change it back. And a few days later, they did change it.
So Google has gone its own way, despite what the UN tells the world to do. Has it ever helped the situation, or has it only complicated them?
When South Sudan gained independence in 2011, it was admitted to the United Nations 2 days later, but that declaration didn't actually include any data about borders. Because there was no authoritative source of the geographical information, Google actually collaborated with local citizens, with the World Bank, and with some UN organizations to crowdsource that data, to ask locals, you know, what is the border of this new territory? And they were able to publish that data much more quickly than traditional mapping institutions might have been able to.
It's like Google really is its own nation state and stepped in here to negotiate.
I think they would be hesitant to characterize themselves as a nation state, but all the tech companies, they are taking on a really unprecedented role in global affairs. They've amassed so many users and they're so influential that anything they do lends legitimacy to whatever it is that they're conveying. It's hard to anticipate the impact that technology will have on the institutions we've relied on for decades, if not hundreds of years. We can hope and work towards a future where that technology serves our interests. But if we don't work together and if we don't expect companies to think bigger than their immediate interests, then we're not going to end up in that world.
Although, why should we hold Google to a different standard than the United States government?
Well, as companies have taken on roles that have traditionally been that of nation states, I think we should hold them to a higher standard. If they're creating maps, building the infrastructure for democratic discourse, we should expect that they're going to be accountable to their users in a way that goes beyond profit.
Miranda, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Miranda Bogan is a policy analyst at Upturn, a DC nonprofit that studies the intersection of technology and social issues. It's remarkably easy for Google to change our view of the world's boundaries. It's a lot tougher to shift our impression of the world's peoples. Since first launching in 1888, National Geographic has been serving up striking photojournalism that trains its readers about how to think about far-flung places and peoples. Some of that thinking has been illuminating and broadening. Some of it reductive and dismissive. Now, as the nation takes an increasingly hard look at its racist perspectives and policies, National Geographic has turned its focus toward how we might have developed them and what they've produced. The magazine's first step, taking a deep dive into its own archives and finding some troubling coverage in its past. Susan Goldberg has been editor-in-chief at National Geographic since 2014. She understood that she couldn't move forward on the project until the magazine had examined its own often troublesome history.
We set out in a colonial world. That's when we started and covered things through that lens. You know, as recently as a year ago, we did a story about the run-up to the Second World War. The fact that our coverage of Germany was not as critical as it should have been.
I think you're putting that mildly.
Yes, I am, actually.
Yeah, you're not a stranger to self-examination, but because of the time of National Geographic's birth and the demographics of the National Geographic Society, I mean, these were very colonial enterprises. They regarded themselves as not just different from the people that they met, but quite explicitly superior.
And we really thought it was important to get some outside views on this, and so we found John Edward Mason, a wonderful historian at the University of Virginia, to help with this examination. Dr. Mason is not just a historian, but an expert in Africa and in photography. So that is the crossroads of so much of our storytelling. So he was ideally suited to help us.
And he dove into your archives, and what did he discover that you found most excruciating?
Well, to me, one of the most painful things that he found was a caption on a story that we ran in 1916 about some Aboriginal people in Australia, and the caption talked about them really in subhuman terms, being the lowest of intelligence of any people. That's a tough thing to look at in your own archive, but I think it's important that we do.
In 1941, the magazine referred to black California cotton workers as pickaninnies. That's a lot later than 1916.
That is a lot later. Too often, when we looked at people of color in the United States at all, it was in terms of their being laborers or domestic workers. And when we looked at people of color all over the world, it was through the lens of them being exotics, happy hunters, tribal swordsmen, native dancers.
You have also critiqued your publication for its sins of omission, not to highlight real racial tension in the U.S. or elsewhere. And Mason offered a tale of two stories, one in 62 and one in 77, both in South Africa.
Right. 1962, when we go to South Africa, just 2 years after the shooting of 69 black South Africans, some as they fled from the police. These were shootings that horrified the world. And our story didn't even mention this shooting, which is very difficult to get your head around. One of the things that Dr. Mason said was that the story didn't have the voices of black South Africans.
There's that great quote. He found it bizarre to consider what the editors, the writers, and the photographers had to consciously not see.
And then when we get to 1977, 15 years later, we go back to South Africa. And, you know, it's not a perfect story, as he points out, but it is a story that has the voices of the opposition. It has the voices of black South Africans. There's a picture of Winnie Mandela with her fist raised. There is a discussion of apartheid. So it is a very, very different take on what's going on in that country and represents reality.
And then if you flash forward to your time, you handed the cameras at one point to Haitians to document their own experience.
Well, in 2015, in addition to sending a photographer who has spent a great deal of time in Haiti and with Haitian people, we gave cameras to a group of young Haitian photographers, and we said, photograph your world. And I think that's increasingly important for us.
You know, it would be easy to write off some of the more egregious oversights of National Geographic in its past as a symptom of its times. But National Geographic was lagging even behind its peers from the same era, such as Life or the New York Times, the Washington Post, or Look magazine. Do you think that its colonial white-gloved origins acted as a brake on seeing the world as it truly was?
You know, I'm not really sure, but the other organizations that you named, they viewed themselves as covering the news. I think that right now we view ourselves much more as a news organization than we ever have. Not that we're covering daily events, but what we're trying to do is cover things that are topical, that are important, and then put them in proper perspective. And I'm not sure that decades and decades ago there was that sense about needing to cover things that felt topical.
There was a sense, perhaps, that science was an academic, tidy process that was best kept clear of news. And we understand now that there's no separation between what is going on in the world and all the forces that power those changes, many of which are scientific.
And so we don't cover politics in a daily way, but we do cover the outcome of policies. For example, when the administration pulls the United States out of the Paris Climate Accords, we're going to step back and take a look at what is going to be the impact of that decision. And we write constantly about subjects like sustainability and scientific innovation in a very timely way because we think that is right in our wheelhouse.
And of course, you are no longer a monthly.
We have 420 million social followers, and we send them news and information every single day.
420 million?
420 million. We have the largest social following of any media in the United States.
Wow, that's kind of a buried lead, isn't it?
And so I'm not trying to make excuses for the sins of the past, but I do think that today's modern storytelling tools, as well as a remaking of our brand from reverence to relevance, as we like to say, has changed our storytelling. And we want to show places as they really are, not as they are in some fantasy or in some picture book.
Let's talk about what I think is the main controversy about this latest issue devoted to race. The cover picture shows beautiful biracial fraternal twins, one white, one black. Rebecca Onion wrote in Slate that she felt like the twins were being used as an oddity. And Jean Denby, an amazing reporter for NPR's Code Switch, said that it seemed to send the message that race is not important anymore, we're all one, you know, that it conveyed a kind of a kumbaya-ness, which is so far from the reality, kind of thing that makes liberals feel good, but can really frustrate people who want to see the consequences of racism front and center.
Well, I couldn't disagree more. The story obviously talks about the parents' hopes, and it quotes the twins talking about how sometimes people stare at them, but it doesn't bother them. And that is one level of storytelling. But the whole issue, including a wonderful story by Betsy Colbert about the science of race, really talks about how these small genetic tweaks result, of course, in very different lives. And we look at those hard statistics that show how people of color don't have the same opportunities that people who are white do, whether it comes to education, to income, to health, to longevity. how race, while it may be a social construct, plays itself out every single day in our politics, in where we can live, and even in our sense of self. You know, race is a tough subject to cover. A lot of people don't want to deal with it. So we've got to figure out what are ways that we can invite people in to having a civilized conversation. The twins aren't the end of the conversation. The twins are the beginning of the conversation.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Susan Goldberg is the editor-in-chief of National Geographic.
Coming up, history resides in maps, photos, journalism, and even memoirs. For instance, Churchill wrote his own slanted story, and that's the one we remember.
This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Darkest Hour is the latest in a long line of Hollywood hagiographies of British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, replete with cigar, bowler hat, and stentorian speeches in Parliament and on the wireless, warning the world about Hitler and rallying a besieged nation to victory.
Hitler will not insist on outrageous terms. He will know his own weaknesses. He will be reasonable.
When will the lesson be learned? When will the lesson be learned? How many more dictators must be wooed, appeased, good God, given immense privileges, before we learn? You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth!
But the caricature of heroic arrogance obscures the fuller picture. As Indian politician Shashi Tharoor wrote in the Washington Post last week, Churchill, the icon of freedom, was also Churchill, the racist imperialist. The mainly shrouded history of his savage efforts to keep Britain's grip on India is told in Churchill's Secret War, the British Empire and the Ravaging of India During World War II, by journalist Madhusree Mukherjee. Madhusree, welcome to On the Media.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We know well the portrayal of Churchill as a wartime hero. We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, and all that. And much of that is just plain history. But history, as they say, belongs to those who write it, and Churchill did just that, huh?
Well, exactly. After the war, he had complete access to all United Kingdom documents. And an entire team of researchers and writers who helped him actually write six volumes or so of his World War II memoirs. And these volumes put Churchill at the center of the war, whereas historians have filled out some of the detail, which is that it was the Soviets who defeated the Nazis and the Americans who defeated the Japanese.
And that was not his first go at writing history or at autobiography, because when his political career was in shards after the First World War, he wrote a history then as well.
He wrote several histories. He wrote something called The History of the English-Speaking People, but he wrote an autobiography, although he was young. It's extremely revealing of his upbringing. He grew up in the Victorian era. His father was Lord Randolph Churchill, Secretary of State for India, and he exhorted Britons to safeguard India, that precious jewel in the crown, because that was what had made Britain an empire to rival possibly even the Romans. So Churchill grew up in this tradition, and he actually writes that, you know, it's too bad that World War I has made war unfashionable, and that we cannot expect to have great wars between the great world powers, but I still hope to have a few savages to shoot at. And he actually says, I hope for an uprising in India so that we can all march down the plains and shoot them and become famous. He was a really accomplished writer, as we all know. He won the Nobel for Literature, which I think is very fitting because it's usually given for fiction.
He also wrote of Iraq. He wrote about Zulus. He wrote about Indian civilians. According to his own Secretary of State for India, Leo Amory, and the most dehumanizing terms.
Amory likened Churchill's views on Indians to those of Hitler's towards lesser peoples. And after the war was almost won, when Churchill was realizing that India would probably be lost, he prescribed this program of reconstructing India according to Soviet lines. Churchill, during the war, was a great admirer of Stalin and wanted to emulate him in certain aspects, such as scorched earth policies.
I guess we need a little bit of historical review here. During the war, he was not idle in India. Can you tell me what was going on there in the 30s and the 40s?
Well, India was a source of resources and also of manpower. It was probably the largest source of manpower for the British Army. But the freedom movement in India had really taken off with Gandhi in the 1930s, at which time even the Tories started to feel that it might be easier to hold India if the people there got some token concessions. So they drafted a constitution for India. And Churchill was so adamant against granting any kind of self-government that he directly attacked the leaders of the Tory party, calling the constitution that they had drafted a monstrous monument of sham built by pygmies. Obviously, this, you know, didn't win him any favors and put him out into the political wilderness until World War II started to stir on the horizon and Churchill rose as someone who was warning against Hitler.
You mentioned Stalin, and in the early 30s, one of the great atrocities of history was the intentional famine, mainly in Ukraine. Churchill in India presided almost an identical tragedy. Can you tell me about the Bengal famine of 1943?
To list the different causes of the Bengal famine of 1943, one was inflationary financing because India was a massive source of resources for Britain's war. It spent about £2 billion on the war and the government didn't have enough money, so it simply printed money. And the money supply increased by 6 or 7 times, and it went mostly to the armaments manufacturers and other war suppliers, and it sucked the food out of the countryside. Then when the Japanese took over Burma in March 1942, that cut off a major source of imports of rice to India. But Churchill's role in all this is that even though India was short of food, he insisted that India instead export food. So India was exporting 40,000 tons of wheat every year and also exporting rice.
And was this primarily for the war effort?
This was primarily for the war effort, but the United Kingdom had put in place a plan to feed its people as early as 1936. They had stockpiles. They had rationing booklets printed and distributed even before the war broke out. In India, although it was completely clear it would be a major source of supplies for the war effort, there were no stockpiles. And when it became clear that the famine is raging, that people are dropping on the streets of Calcutta, several foreign countries offered aid, including the US and Canada. The war cabinet in the UK turned them all down. They said, we're taking care of it. But on August 4th, 1943, there was a meeting at which Amory said, we have a famine. This is causing morale in the Indian Army to drop. We need to feed the people. Churchill and his war cabinet refused to schedule any food at all for India, saying that it was needed elsewhere, except that if 170,000 tons were shipped after that war cabinet meeting to storage, to stockpiles. So you have a famine-stricken country where eventually 3 million people would die, but the food was being stockpiled for future use by Europeans.
In various biographies and filmed biographies of Winston Churchill, the authors seem perplexed that the man who saved England could have become so profoundly unpopular immediately after the war. Some explanations are that his wartime leadership did not carry over to peacetime politics. Were the British people as misled about the whole Churchill as we are in America today?
Churchill was very hostile to the working classes. There had been a miners' strike in which he ordered troops out, and people remembered that. Also, when he was younger, he actually believed that the working classes were an inferior people and advocated sterilizing prison populations and the disabled. So he was an aristocrat to the core. People knew that. And also you have to remember that he wasn't elected prime minister the first time. He got there by replacing Neville Chamberlain because he advocated a strong stand against Hitler. When he was elected the second time, it was probably on the strength of this memoir he wrote, which masqueraded as history, which turned him into a hero.
We were talking about manipulating history by writing it, but there's other subtle ways for someone's historical reputation to belie reality. And some of that's as simple as editing. I did my own embarrassing Churchill impression earlier, but let's listen to the beginning of that most iconic speech to Parliament.
We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
That's inspiring, but we very seldom hear what he had to say next.
And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
In the Blood, Sweat, and Tears speech, he says that the aim of the war is victory, victory at all costs. Without victory, there is no survival, no survival for the British Empire. He gets more and more furious with India because it becomes clear that it cannot be held.
You've written that having defeated the Nazis, Churchill's singular preoccupation turned toward preserving the empire, particularly India. How did he go about that?
He wasn't waiting for the Nazis to be defeated before he did what he thought it would take to hold India, primarily by denying the Indian request for a promise of self-government after the war. And he did all he could to implement divide and rule tactics by encouraging, for example, the Muslim League and the ambition to partition India. Since the Indian National Congress had said it would participate in the war gladly if it could be promised self-government after the war, and Churchill refused to do that, in August 1942, Gandhi declared what he called the Quit India Movement, and the British responded with ferocity using the troops that they had in India. 10,000 people died, crowds were strafed, about 90,000 people were arrested, with Gandhi and all of the major leaders in prison, and no one left in India to speak for the Indian people. The Bengal famine comes about.
Precipitating famine, at least toying with the idea of eugenics, sterilizing prisoners,
yeah,
and the subjugation of brown people on three continents. This is all unambiguously monstrous. Why do you suppose that, particularly on this side of the ocean, we've been so eager to just ignore that and embrace the man for his war heroics?
Well, I think the simple answer is what Churchill himself said. History will be kind to me because I intend to write it. And so it has been, because it is a pleasing history for the West, a time when it stood against a great evil and vanquished it.
So what's the lesson here?
I think the lesson is that every culture has its demons, and sometimes they are the flip side of our heroes, and we should not be afraid to examine them. The Germans have done that, and one could argue that it is because they were defeated that they were forced to take a look at their history.
So truth and reconciliation should not be confined to the losers in epic struggles, but to the winners as well.
It's the winners who owe it themselves to look at their history dispassionately and decide what can or should be changed and what is okay.
Madhusri, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madhusri Mukherjee is a senior editor of Scientific American and author of two books, including Churchill's Secret War, The British Empire, and the Ravaging of India During World War II. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Michael Loewinger, and Leah Fetter. We had more help from John Hanrahan, Isaac Napel, and Philip Yiannopoulos. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.